Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another reality show. I'm your host, Golden Hawk, and wow, 2010, we're in the midst of it. We're 14 days into 2010, and as I promised at the beginning of the year, I got a rockin' show for everybody tonight. I have a guest that I'm super excited to be speaking with. I know you guys are going to be excited too. All right, let me get him introduced. For over 25 years, Paul Rademacher has been studying the intersection between consciousness, spirituality, and the Christian tradition. Since October of 2007, he has served as the executive director of the Monroe Institute. Mr. Rademacher, or Paul as we're going to refer to him, was able to bring together the worlds of spirituality and consciousness by introducing the Monroe mythology to small groups within his congregation. Through courses he designed and taught, the participants were not only able to move personally into profound altered states of consciousness, but were also able to see the connection between these states and what Jesus termed as the kingdom of heaven. For most of them, it was their first introduction to perceptions beyond the physical body, an experience that was life-changing for many. Author of A Spiritual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, which is, I believe the term is autobiographical, an autobiography, but if I'm wrong on that, Paul, you correct me on that. So please help me welcome Paul to the show. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Goldie. It's a wonderful to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely my pleasure. Now, you are just a man. You are a man with a story, my friend. And I want to share truly your journey. Now, was that correct? Is A Spiritual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, is that considered an autobiography?
Yeah, autobiography or a memoir or, you know, take your pick.
Okay, memoir too was another term that I was like, I don't know if there's, right, okay. It's a fabulous book. I mean, it's a great read, not only because of the way it was written, but your journey, I mean, as a human being, you know, on planet Earth, so to speak, is really fascinating. And I resonated very deeply with a lot of the hesitations and the awakenings and, you know, some of the pain, which, you know, clearly seems to be a part of this journey. So why don't we start? Can you introduce yourself, kind of like who you are and how you started off as a minister, and we'll go from there?
Sure, I'd be glad to.
Thanks.
In a lot of ways, the story begins for me when I was building industry. My brother and I had a construction company, and one day we were building a home, and I was up on the roof, working on the roof, and pulling on a board, and all of a sudden, without any warning, the board gave way, and I found myself careening off the roof, and I landed on a pile of gravel and missed the base of a crane that we had there by about 6 inches with my head. And I didn't know it at the time, but I had fractured my left hip. But I was in an awful lot of pain, so they took me to the hospital in the ambulance and put me through x-rays, and they didn't find anything wrong with the hip. And so they put me in physical therapy, which I got to tell you is absolutely not where you want to end up if you've got a fractured hip. And so the doctor came by after a while, and he's looking at me. He said, "Paul, you don't look like you're doing so well." And I said, "Doc, I'm really not." And so he said, "Well, let's take another look at that hip." So they did some more x-rays, and they found that it was, in fact, fractured. Took me out of physical therapy and then put me into traction. When the doctor came by to tell me that I was going to be off work for a number of weeks, I felt myself going into this spiral of pain and anxiety, pain because the hip was excruciating, and anxiety because this was the busiest time of our construction year, and there was absolutely no way I could possibly be off work. So as I felt myself literally going downward in this spiral, and all of a sudden, without any kind of warning, I broke through into another reality. And I wasn't prepared for this in any way, because it wasn't as if I had done any study or meditation. I was a terrible meditator, and I'm really kind of still pretty bad at it today. But I'm just an ordinary contractor, and all of a sudden I'm in this other reality. And in this other world, the pain completely evaporated from the hip, and the anxiety dissipated completely, and I found myself surrounded by total and unbelievable peace. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that there were no such things as accidents. Everything had meaning and purpose and was just exactly the way it was meant to be. And then at one point in the experience, I found myself standing in front of a being of light, and we are conversing about my life, but without words. I think it's probably more kind of a telepathic communication.
Okay.
This day, I don't even remember what we talked about, but it was terribly profound for me. And when I came out of that experience, I was just really blown away because I wasn't prepared for it. It was simply something that I fell into. And little did I know that from that point on, the pursuit of that world would become the focus of my life.
May I ask you how old you were when you had that experience?
You know, that's a good question. I'm thinking that was, let's see, that was back in 1980, so 80, 81. So I was probably 28 or 29, something like that.
Okay, because my awakening happened when I was 30. I think it's almost like set points, like there's a puberty, but there's also set points of soul experiences. I don't know if there's necessarily ages, but the more I seem to talk to people, midlife crises are often, you know, our souls coming more into our being, you know, shaking things up and going, oh, you know, you used to like this and now you have no interest in it.
Right. I think we're one of the problems with our society is that we're not very attentive to those markers. If you look at traditional societies, you know, there's always this sort of coming of age and there's a real embracing of the mystical dimension. And we for several generations now have virtually eliminated that mystical component of life. And so we don't have any rituals or any ways of marking the advent of those kinds of experiences. And so in our society, for the most part, you're left on your own and you're caught by surprise.
Absolutely. And yet, nonetheless, these are happening to us.
Right.
Which is why, you know, this is good that we talk about it, because I definitely want to go on with the story, but I think there are bookmarks here, so to speak, that I want people to hear at one of the lowest points of most pain and fear and anxiety in your experience, this happened. So I tell people all the time, when you've been through enough quote-unquote dark nights of the soul, you recognize that it's not, you don't earn a mystical experience. I don't quite know what determines it, but I know that it's determined beyond what we think is our name, our occupation, our financial status, things like that don't determine. It's just there's something can happen that can just make you, your whole perception go, well, wow, what I thought was A, you know, is really B, C, D, and E. You know, it like you said, it starts you on a journey that is like profound.
I like what you say there, you know, because it's not something that we necessarily earn. I think that it's more grace in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, there are certainly techniques that can help to promote you and propel you in that direction. But, you know, in a lot of ways, there is that divine accident, if you will, that will take us by surprise. And I think sometimes we don't give that enough credit for the twists and turns of our lives.
Well said. Please continue.
Well, after I came out of that experience, I had been wrestling with a question, and the question was, should I or should I not go to seminary? I had a real strong sense of calling into the ministry, and you know, my wife and I had been looking for kind of the definitive sign that was going to tell us once and for all that sure, this is where God wants us to go. And, you know, there were a series of things that happened, but we really wanted to be sure because this was going to be a major change in our lives. We had two children at the time. It would mean moving away from their grandparents and also moving away from extended family and friends that we had developed. And and moving away from a job that was paying the bills. And so we wanted to really be sure. And it wasn't until this experience happened that I had the sense that obviously, well, this must be the voice of God. And so when that happened, my wife and I agreed that we would go off to seminary. So I took her and my, at that time, two children. And I entered into Princeton Theological Seminary and graduated 3 years later with a Master of Divinity degree.
Okay. You know, God bless that your wife supported you. There are many relationships that actually that's the critical time when it doesn't, you know, when one gets the calling, if the other one hasn't had it, they think you're crazy.
Well, you know, whether they think you or not, you probably are crazy.
Indeed. I agree. It is crazy, but there's a level of, well, I know people that would say it's crazy to live without a connection to your soul. I mean, Eckhart Tolle speaks on that all the time, that it's crazy the way we live our lives disconnected. You know, that's the real insanity.
That's really true. So. And, you know, your point about my wife's name is Jackie, by the way, and she has been such a tremendous support and mentor and friend and confidant and throughout my life. And in fact, you know, her willingness to go off to seminary and change our lives completely for me was really one of the initial signs that made me think about this pretty seriously, because she didn't even bat an eye. It was just like, oh yeah, well, let's go. And I said, wait a minute, I'm not ready. What do you mean, let's go? And she said, no. I said, no, I think you'd be really good
that's
at it.
And you really do paint that beautifully in the book. I want to state that the best part about it, I read these wonderful books. I mean, you know, I just feel like I'm one of your family, because the book is just written. You really, you become part of your life and your wife and your children. It's just fabulous. So you did portray that beautifully in the book.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that was kind of what started me on that journey. And I think that after I had the experience of falling off the roof, originally I thought it was just to answer that question about going to seminary. But over time, I began to realize that there was much more behind it than that. And I think the deeper aspect and the more compelling aspect over time was that when I entered into that other dimension, that other world, that mystical realm of magic and wonder and mystery, it created a real hunger in me to want to get back to that domain and to touch it and to enter into it in a more consistent manner. And I didn't realize how deep that hunger would be, but, you know, that literally became the work of my life from that point on, even though it took me a long time to recognize that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a kind of what we were speaking of a few moments ago. It's like the tribe often doesn't support the type of mystical experiences that a person has. In other words, if they haven't had the mystical experience, they really don't know what it's like to walk between worlds. How do you describe that without, you know, the reference being, do we need to, you know, put you on antipsychotics and take you to the white coat room? You know, it's there's so much in the culture that, like we were saying also earlier, that doesn't support these very real and very tangible experiences, but only real and tangible if you've had them.
Right, and that's where I think the experience is so much more compelling than language. Language always seems to fail in conveying the experience. You know, Joseph Campbell, in his marvelous book, what's it called, The Hero's Journey or something like that, talks about the hero's journey as being something that where inevitably you move from this everyday mundane world into some other kind of magical, mystical experience, and that's just the beginning of the task. The real task happens when the traveler has to come back and try to convey the essence of the experience to those who have not had it. And he has a great quote, and I wish I could remember it, but this is sort of a paraphrasing. He comes back and he talks to people who think that they are whole but are mere fractions, And so they don't even realize.
Yes, that is very, absolutely.
Right.
I mean, and I can't wait to get into the second hour because, I mean, the beauty of where you work is it a guarantee? I mean, and we'll get into the whole Hemi-Sing procedure, but does everybody who goes through the process have an experience because of the technology?
Well, no, we can't guarantee that because we don't know where any individual people are. What we do find is that the vast majority of people who come through do have life-changing experiences. A normal group size would be about 24, and out of those 24, we might have one or two or maybe three who walk away from it saying, you know, I just didn't get what I was hoping for. But the vast majority of the other ones, they will come back and say, this was the best week of my life, this absolutely changed who I am.
Oh, don't you love it? I mean, we were speaking briefly before the show, and it really must be quite an honor to, I mean, literally watch hundreds of people go through awakenings. I kind of have it in a small circle. I know my radio show does it on some level, but the Hemi-Sync is just, God bless Robert Monroe. God bless that man. And his family and you. I mean, it just really, to me, feels like this is where we are in consciousness that, I mean, it used to be seminary school is when I think, you know, many of the mystics, you know, they were nuns and priests and monks.
Right.
Now we're looking at the potential of housewives and dental assistants and doctor, meaning, which is really, when you think about it, to open it up to everyone, what a profound shift in the whole way we would actually live our lives, like doctors have coming, medical doctors coming and having experiences, recognizing, to treat a patient, we would have to treat the soul and the emotions clearly as importantly as the cellular structure.
Carolyn Mace has a great
quote. I love Carolyn! Sorry.
So you probably heard it when she talks then about we're entering a time now where we're being called to be mystics without monasteries. So that ordinary people, just as you say, we're moving into a time where more and more, because of the hunger that has arisen because of the fact that we have neglected this area for so long, that hunger is sort of driving us forward as a culture where ordinary people are beginning to have these experiences where they're moving into extraordinary worlds.
Okay, the door is just open. Paul, I so want to talk about your story, but this is, I'm jazzed, I'm stoked, and Carolyn is like, okay, she's giving us the go-ahead. Okay, can you describe the essence or the basics of the Hemi-Sync procedure?
Okay, all right.
I can't wait anymore. I'm sorry.
All right. That's not a problem.
Thanks.
I wear two hats, and your listeners probably should know that. One is the author of the book, and the other is the executive director of the Monroe Institute. So I'm happy to switch hats here without no problem whatsoever.
Thank you. I tend to be I'm a bull in a china shop. I don't know graceful transitions. I get excited about something and then I just kind of jump. So I appreciate your flexibility on that.
Well, we're obviously being led in different directions, so not a problem. Let me go back and kind of tell the story about Robert Monroe and how he got into the whole work. Is that okay?
Yes. Awesome.
All right. So Robert Monroe was a radio man. He was a very prolific producer of radio shows. I think at one point in his career, he was writing and producing something like 18 different radio shows within a one-week period. So the man was like a machine. He rose up through the ranks and eventually became a vice president of Mutual Broadcasting System. Well, there was back in the 1950s, there was this new medium that was coming to the fore, and it was called television. And so Robert and his production company were looking at that and trying to figure out, do we want to move into television production, Or do we want to, because they knew what it would take to start up with a new medium like that. It was going to be a tremendously difficult thing. Or did he want to try to do something else? And because he was involved in sound and he knew sound, he got kind of intrigued with this idea of maybe seeing if people could learn while they were sleeping. And so one of the things that they had to do was to find some way of getting people to sleep without using drugs or without knocking them unconscious, so that they could begin to test some of the things that they were doing. So he developed a series of sound patterns that helped people to get to sleep. It was about this same time that he himself, I think, was one of his own best test subjects. And I don't know whether it was because of listening to the sound patterns or simply synchronicity. One evening he went to bed, and as he was lying in bed, he was thinking about the next day, and the next day he was going to be going up in a glider, because he loved being a glider pilot, and the conditions were going to be absolutely perfect. So he was very excited about that. And he's laying there, and all of a sudden he feels himself lying against this flat, hard surface, which was really puzzling, because the last thing he knew, he was in bed.
Mm.
He's thinking, how in the world did I get out of the bed? And what's more, he looked, and coming out of this flat, hard surface was something that looked like a fountain. It was very, very confusing to him. And all of a sudden, he got himself kind of reoriented and turned around and realized that he was actually bouncing against the ceiling. And what looked like the fountain was actually the chandelier that was hanging down from the ceiling. So he looked down at the bed where he had been lying, and he saw his wife. And there was this other man in bed with his wife, and that seemed pretty strange. And then all of a sudden, he realized that the other man was himself.
Mm.
Swam back down through the air, got back into his body, sat up, his heart was pounding, he was out of breath. He was terrified because he was convinced that he was dying. So imagine, if you will, that this is in the 1950s when very little information about this kind of experience is available. It's certainly not the common parlance that it is today.
And absolutely.
So he went through a series of tests to make sure that he wasn't dying, and even psychological tests, and they said he was relatively sane. And then he got really curious about it, and he began to wonder if he could use these sound patterns to help himself to control what was essentially an uncontrollable situation, because he kept having spontaneous out-of-body experiences. And over time, he invited a lot of other people into the experimentation. So you couldn't go over to Bob Monroe's house and sit and have a cocktail, because 10 minutes after you walked through the door, he'd be shoving you into the dark room and putting some headphones on your head.
That's my kind of guy, though. Yeah. God bless. God bless exploration.
And through that exploration, you know, he developed these sound patterns that help people to move into altered states of experience. Not just the out-of-body experience, but many other ranges of perception that are available to the human condition. So that's kind of the history behind how this work got started.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's fabulous. Okay, now let's get into the frequencies.
Okay. So the way that the frequencies work is that and this is a very, very simplified version of what goes on. It's much more complex than this. But if you have a set of headphones on, what we would do would put one signal at a certain frequency in one ear, and then in the other ear we would put a different frequency that's just a little bit different. So, for instance, if you have a frequency of 100 cycles per second in one ear and 104 cycles per second in the other ear, what happens is that the brain begins to manufacture a third tone, which is sort of like a vibrato. If you've ever tuned a guitar or something like that, when the strings get close enough but they're not quite in tune, there will be sort of a wavering sound. That is that third tone. And that third tone is what we call the binaural beat, and that helps the brain to acclimate to a different environment. And so it will help to induce the brain to move into a ranges of perception that that would be different from normal waking consciousness.
Okay.
The signals themselves are actually quite a bit more complex than that, because if you were just to have the straight binaural beat, after a while the brain would get habituated to that and just begin to ignore it. And so we help people to move into, by varying those tones and the patterns to some extent, we help people to not to get habituated to it and to move more directly into these states. And what Robert Monroe did was to help to kind of create a map of consciousness for people.
Mm.
So, for instance, in our programs, we take people to different destination points along the way that have been mapped out over the years.
Okay, so can you define a destination point?
Sure, sure.
Okay.
What we do use, and by the way, I want to emphasize to everybody that. By no means do we insist that this is the map. This is just a map that has been useful to a great number of people, and we have respect for all the other maps that are out there. But this one seems to work pretty well.
Indeed.
Go ahead.
No, I'm agreeing with you. I just tend to interrupt when I do that. Sorry.
All right. So, for instance, the first destination point that we take people is what we call Focus 10. And Robert Monroe used numbers because he wanted to use designations that weren't front-loaded and filled with bias and preconceptions. And numbers tend to be relatively neutral. So Focus 10 is the state of what we call mind awake, body asleep. And what this means is that simply that normally as our body gets progressively relaxed, for instance, when we lie down in the bed at night, there comes a point in time where we cross over this threshold and we lose consciousness and we enter into sleep. What we help people to do is to sort of shift that crossover line to some extent so that the body can get progressively more and more relaxed, even the body can start to fall asleep, and we help people to maintain their waking consciousness when that happens. What this allows then is for people to begin to explore ranges of perception that they are normally unconscious to as they go into sleep. And so, as you can imagine, there's an endless world that can come into focus at that point in time.
Would that be considered lucid dreaming?
Well, you know, lucid dreaming can certainly be a part of it. What we find is that this is more of a doorway or a gateway that people can pass through. And once they pass through it, what happens on the other side of that gateway is entirely unique to that person. So, for instance, some people could have visions. Some people could have out-of-body experiences. Some people could have lucid dreamings. Some people could have a deep sense of intuition. Some people could contact loved ones who've passed over on the other side. So all we do is we simply create a context, and then people can move through that door. And once they move through the door, at that point, even though everybody's using the same signals, it becomes a very highly individualized process.
Yeah, and that's what makes it feel so, you know, that's the beauty of that. In other words, the same signals, but of course a mystical experience is going to be a personal experience. God is very personal.
Yeah.
Becoming aware of God is a very personal experience, whether through hemisync or falling off a building. You know,
right.
That's the experience.
Exactly, and that's why what's so fascinating about this process, and this is what I really love about the Institute, is that we have no dogma.
Yeah.
I said I was wearing two hats. So my first hat, I was coming out of my own personal experience within the Christian tradition. Now I've got the Monroe Executive Director hat on, and with that hat on, I want people to understand that we don't have any dogma. The only thing that we ask people to consider is the possibility that they might be more than their physical bodies. We don't try to tell them what that more is. We just simply create the context for their own exploration. Then we say, well, you go and find out, and then you come back and you tell us what you discovered. And
yeah,
so,
that's hot. That's hot.
Yeah, so we don't have any gurus and we don't have any shamans. What we really want is for people to be their own gurus and to begin to trust their own intuition.
Those are powerful, powerful statements of intention. I honor that tremendously because my personal belief is where we are now as a planet, as a cosmos, is we must step into the maturity of self and trust. We must start learning to trust ourselves and stop giving our power away to the gurus and to the popes and the priests. And I'm not saying not to honor these people, but we can't give our experiences and our beliefs and what is right for us to another person, because it's an impossibility. You are that experience. It has to come from self. At least that's been my experience.
Well, and I agree with you totally on that, because when we allow the other person to have the experience for us, we're cutting ourselves off from the full range of what it means to be human. And,
yes.
Then we place ourselves at their mercy, and essentially we're asking them to control our lives, and which is really kind of an affront when you think about it to this gift that we have been given.
Yes.
We've been given this gift of life, and to give somebody else the power to choose what we should do with that life is really kind of abdicating from the gift.
And I believe the planet at this point is maturity, it's demand. If we're going to continue to give that power away, the planet is so out of balance because of that. We're destabilizing. We're not stable because of that level of consciousness.
Well,
you know, that's why. Oh, please.
When we're out of touch with the world that is beyond the physical, and we get out of balance ourselves, and then that translates to being out of balance with the planet. And I think the two have to go together. You know, so many people think that when you move into the metaphysical or the spiritual domain, that you sort of leave the planet to some extent, that you become ungrounded. But I think just the opposite happens. When you move deeply into these wonderful states, you also move into that sense of oneness that that is at the foundation of everything. And that oneness then also not only helps you to connect with other people, but it also helps you to connect more directly with the earth. And I agree with you totally, Goldie. I think you're making a really powerful statement there when you say that's the reason why we're out of balance, is that we've neglected the spiritual side of ourselves, and that spiritual side has a direct impact to our relationship to the earth.
Oh, definitely. And the beauty of what Henry Sink, with numerous other meditations or whatever tools you want to use, is you go through the body to get to the unlimited vastness. Not, in other words, through the sleep in the body, you can get then beyond the body. But, I know when I was first on this journey of awakening, I really did think, it was like, how do I get off this planet fast and furiously? I don't like it here. And I have absolutely learned that it is by grounding, it's being present in my body, and then from that point going into, it's a gateway into, the vastness is not outer space, the vastness is inner space.
Right.
That's where true vastness of who I am is. And when I get that, it's when I start seeing what one of my teachers calls changeless change. You know, as I change within, it effortlessly changes on the outside for me.
That's right. One of our facilitators has a great comment about that. She says that so many people come to the Institute looking for an out-of-body experience, and they don't even realize that they've never had a truly in-body experience.
Exactly. Yes, beautifully stated. And again, I think that's very important, because I still hear many quote-unquote light workers speaking about the astral travel and, getting out there. And it's like, it's a natural thing. I understand to want the expansiveness. It's just redirected, exactly like you said, into body. There is a very big world, forget world, spaceless space, timeless time. All of that exists within us.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah.
It's very powerful stuff.
And that's what brings the magic into this world.
Yes.
It's so easy to, as you were talking before, to sort of get depressed about life and the mundane aspects of the workaday world. But when you start to transcend the body and also at the same time move deeply into the body, then that's when the world becomes magical, and you also begin to realize that the material world is communicating with us all the time, and that it has a spiritual essence that is incredibly wondrous and beautiful.
Absolutely. Absolutely well stated. Because, you know, I honor the journeys of whether it be Catholicism, Judaism, Hindu, shamanism, as long as they're always telling the being it starts with self, not with, you know, I'll get you there. No. Because I tell people all the time, listen to my show, but do the work or do the play. Because it used to be work to me. Now this is total play. I mean, this is, when life becomes magical and mystical, it is unbelievable what synchronicities happen and things just come to you. I mean, effortlessly. And it's weird, effortlessly from the third dimensional perspective, but not so much effortlessly in the sense of, there, I think it does take effort to shift the focus from, you know, our conditioning says that if we're going to be safe, you know, that whole Maslow hierarchy, we have to take care of, you know, the survival instinct says we have to take care of our environment. And I am, you know, I believe this is an endless journey, but I am truly learning that my environment reflects my safety and my abundance and my magic and my mysteries when I go within. You know, in other words, there's no relationship that is outside that has more precedence than me with me, which is also my reference of me with the God, goddess, creator, you know, pick a term,
right.
Go science, universe, cosmos. But there's a major, like, it's what I call the quantum leap, when people start saying that I'm going to focus on within as a priority. Carolyn Mace talks about this as well, as opposed to the outer world being the priority, which is why I love stories like yours, because, you know, most people, when they're at that crossroad where, you know, if they're losing the house and the job, you know, or the relationship, or, you know, something's happening where you can just sense that the soul is kind of, you know, coming up within their being to say, part of why you're losing what appears to be everything is because there's a world where what you thought was everything is just a small fraction of what genuinely everything is. You know, and there's so much of that happening right now. I love having you as a guest, because I really do want to help people understand what looks like something terrible can be one of the greatest gifts to changing the rest of your life, from, you know, the shackles of fear and doubt to the adventures of a pioneer.
Yeah.
Going through the cosmos.
You know,
I get way excited. Please.
Come into this world, you know, to learn, and some of our greatest teachers are the most difficult things that we run into, the events that happen in our lives, and sometimes some of the most difficult people too, because particularly people that drive us crazy are often mirrors of what's going on in our world that we simply can't see for ourselves, and they mirror that for us. And so I've always noticed that whenever somebody really enrages me, that's kind of a tip-off that, hey, wait a minute, they're showing me something that I really need to look at that's within me. And that's why, you know, I think that, you know, kind of tying back to what you were saying before, that this sort of understanding who we are, I think that's why the perennial wisdom has always been to know thyself as the basis for the spiritual path and for the greatest growth. And, you know, I think that's one of the interesting things about the work that we do at the Institute is, you know, if a person is able to entertain the possibility that they might be more than their physical body, then that puts that question of who am I in a completely different context.
Absolutely.
If you think about all the time and energy that we spend in maintaining the physical body and dressing it up and putting makeup on and perfume and you know, the making sure it's got a house to live in and a great car to drive and
exactly
and the right shoes to wear. You got to have the right shoes.
Okay.
So when you think about all the energy we put into that, inevitably we begin to identify with the physical body, and which is okay, but at the same time, then we get to thinking that the limitation of who we are, the boundary, is the same as where our skin begins and ends.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you are able to begin to have the experience, not just talk about, but the actual experience of knowing yourself as something that may be more than the physical body, then you're confronted with a serious, serious question. Now, who am I? And then where do I begin and where do I end? What is my, does my beginning and ending somehow interface with the other people around me in a different way than I ever considered before? And if you start to move beyond time, which we do at the Institute, then you're faced with the question of, well, wait a minute, where am I? And, you know, where, what era am I living? Do I, you know, does my life span all of this? So I think that that's where, you know, when you start to explore that, what appears to be a very simple question is, who am I, then leads you on a really extraordinary journey.
Absolutely. Eloquently stated. Absolutely. You know, because one of the things that in the who am I and the timelessness and all that is, it literally, like for me, one of my defining moments was when my mother died.
Mm.
And it's like I was very much in an I loved my mom. She was my best friend. She also did a lot of enabling, and there was some issues going on. But when she died, I mean, all I knew was in my heart, two things happened. One, the emotions that I experienced I was petrified. I mean, absolutely, like, it felt like the umbilical cord for me was actually cut when she died. And that alone gave me a sense of everything was challenged. I mean, I used to tell my friends, I felt like I was a kitten in the middle of rush hour on the highway. Like, the world just became hugely big and scary, and I had no control. And what all that energy ended up creating was this passion that, okay, if she's on the other side, for, you know, lack of a better term at that time, I was like, I've got an angel that knows me pretty well. I need to stay connected to that angel because, you know, once the fear died down that I could live without her, which, I mean, I tell my friends, my mom gave me two great gifts. She bore me, and then she died, which was my second birth, because I had no idea the strength I really had until I lived through that such an emotionally distraught time for myself. It just, I mean, I have done drugs and all sorts of crazy things in my life, but her dying was just, part of me died as well, which is very, shamans often talk about the death and rebirth. There is no, life is the constant, and then we go through cycles of death and rebirth, and death and rebirth, it's never an end. It's always a new chapter, a new chapter, a new beginning. It's an ending, but it's never just an ending. It's simultaneously a new beginning. So it's almost like, again, you know, that language barrier thing.
Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me? Paul? Oh, my. Okay, we have lost the guest. I'm sure he's going to call back. So in the meantime, I will continue with what I was saying, and we, of course, will take Paul back when he calls. Anyway, so when I lost my mom, That was an ending. That was a beginning. Okay, Paul is back. Let me get him back unmuted.
I don't know what happened. Oh, you were talking. All of a sudden, I didn't hear you anymore. But I'm glad
to
be back.
Yeah, this is frequencies, and this happens more often than not. I knew you'd come back. I knew it would be smooth. And this is just part of when we're dealing with things that are just kind of multidimensional, with things like electronics and computers and stuff. I don't know what happened. I am clearly happy you're back, though.
Yeah, it does happen occasionally. That's for sure. But, you know, before I lost you, I was going to say something really profound. Now I forget what it was. So I hope that maybe you'll remind me.
Okay. Well, I was basically speaking about that life is a constant, and what we believe as death and birth. We're inadequate in our verbiage, because it should really be, if we're going to say it accurately, death and rebirth, and it does not mean it's never just an end. It's impossible to just end without consistently beginning something simultaneously, because when people are like, you know, I don't understand something that's never ended and never began, and it's like, see, but that's self. That's a huge part of self, to not understand that concept. Is a huge piece of the understanding of how we are just life. There is no opposite. Death is not the opposite of life. Birth is the opposite of death. In my opinion, life just is. It just, you know, and I'm not saying I'm aware of it constantly, but I'm aware of enough death that like my mom died, I died too. And it was painful.
How old were you when your mom died?
35.
Uh-huh, yeah. I was really curious. Have you had a sense of her presence since she's died?
Oh, my God. She has taken me through wormholes. She has shown me Mother Earth. I swam with the whales. I flew with the hawks. She has shown up. I had a lucid dream with her. She's absolutely still present with me, and ironically telling me, boy, I had a lot to learn from you. And here's the amazing cycle of it all. I have gotten the sense, I'm 44, I haven't had children yet. It's still my goal to have them. She might be the soul as my child, which would be the ultimate recycling. My mom would be my child.
There you go.
But, well, you know,
We want you to be ecologically sound when everything's
you know, we don't want to waste any souls.
That's right.
Well, but it really is, when you get the perspective and the point of view, you recognize that that is not completely out of the realm of potential or possibility.
Right.
That I can actually birth my mother as much as my mother birthed me.
Yeah, you try to tell that to the average person, and again, they think you're crazy. But you know, I think you're really into the very deep stuff when you're talking about that. And of course, we see that kind of thing all the time at the Institute, where people, even though they might not be looking for it, they will often encounter loved ones who have passed on to the other side, and it seems like every time that they do, it's a very, very profound and life-changing experience for them. And it brings that after-death world in much clearer focus, so that you begin to realize that what we consider to be this impenetrable veil between the worlds really isn't so impenetrable at all. It really is something that we have sort of been invited to explore, as just as we're invited to explore this world as well.
Oh, beautifully stated. And that is what being a multidimensional person is all about. I mean, because, like, I'm going to throw this at you, and this is kind of just, you know, Goldie and Paul talking.
Sure.
All right, because I've been getting this sense that, okay, time and space are very directly correlated, because time is really just about a point in space.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I am becoming a timeless, spaceless consciousness, if I'm becoming aware of that, I believe I already am, I'm becoming aware of that, that would mean what people call the veil of, like, you know, like science has kind of proven the string theory, or not proven. It's considered, you know, string theory is considered one of the possibilities of how to describe life itself, that there's 11 dimensions and every potential is being experienced. We might not be conscious of it, but every potential is being experienced. And I'm thinking to myself, so if I become timeless and spaceless, that would mean, like, the unifying aspect of ascension is about me knowing in my being every experience that's ever happened to me. You know, in other words, those veils keep those 11 dimensions separate, but if that's what's thinning time as a now, past and future being neither, just being now, and then me having that as an experience, like as a point of reference, like I can go anywhere, any when,
right.
And then you can even go into any who.
Right. Exactly.
How profound.
Yeah, that which gets back to what I was saying before, that this is part of the exploration of that question, who am I? And this is the impulse to know thyself. It's not at all a simple journey. It's one of great profundity. I loved what you were saying about how time, for instance, is related to space. And, you know, when you think about it, when you think about what we know as time, as the hours and the minutes of our lives, inevitably they are tied to a place in space. It depends on where are you on the planet as to what time it is. Where that planet is as it's circling the sun, as to what time of year it is, where the sun is in the place of the galaxy as to what century it is, and so you can go on and on, and so but when you begin to explore the possibility that you may be more than your physical body, which may also indicate that you might be more than the physical world, if you're moving beyond the confines of the physical world, then you're also moving beyond those particular points in space. Which means that you're moving beyond time, and yes, you're exactly right, that when you move into that timeless state, then a tremendous amount of information is available to you for your exploration.
Oh, you're beautiful. 'Cause, see, I get these ideas, and I love a guest that can bring, you know, because I tend to almost say it too vastly. You know, my friends are all like, Goldie, remember when you were just starting? And it's like, I try to remember, but I just come up with these things. I don't necessarily know how to say it, and you said it exquisitely, so thank you.
Well, thank you. You're the one who set it up, so.
Oh, well, it's the microcosm and the macrocosm. When both can be explained in a, like, tangible way, I think there's just tremendous, you know, it's like, for me, I'm a very visual speaker. What me and you just danced with, it's like we just turned a couple of cylinders in a safe that allow people to get a clarity, and they go, wow. You know, just to even ponder the idea that we are, you know, everything based on this is, you know, you start with time, then you go to space, and then you go to, you know, people and being. I mean, all of a sudden, 90% of our brain that we call junk DNA, you know, you start going, I wonder, you know, there's an excellent chance, I'm sure that's going to come online and tell us kind of, you know, just intuitively or instinctively or naturally would be the word, very naturally what we are to do with all this new information that we're becoming aware of, how to process it and how to become a mature, enlightened society or species. Because that is, in my personal opinion, I don't believe this is Armageddon. I don't believe 2012 is going to end in World War III. I don't believe in any of that. And I'm not saying, you know, people, like my belief is, if somebody believes an asteroid is going to come and hit planet Earth with enough passion and focused intent, I could easily see them driving along a highway and a big boulder comes down and squashes their car, which is ultimately an asteroid coming. You know what I mean? Like, we can create things in this dimension to fit that dream or that, you know, that vision, But if people are open to it, have you ever heard of a guy named Terrence McKinnon?
The name is familiar, but I can't place. Tell me about him.
Okay, he did a lot of talking. He worked with ayahuasca and a lot of hallucinogenics and kind of along the Leary line. But he had this statement that I found very profound. He said, you know, if you were walking on a path and you came upon a woman who was giving birth, but you had never been told or ever heard of somebody giving birth, you would look at this experience in a way of, it would look violent, it would look, you know, clearly like, you know, abstract and crazy, like, you know, the blood and, you know, the being coming out from between her legs and the breathing and the screaming. It would look like something very negative. And I personally believe that this awakening that we're going through is really a birthing process, that because we're not, you know, many of us are not familiar with walking between the worlds, it just looks so violent and angry, when in actuality it's labor. You know, we are really going into a cosmic birthing of the junk DNA getting turned on and dark matter in the universe getting, oh, is that what that is? You know, whatever that it is, but like we're becoming aware of whatever that it's going to be. And it'll all make sense because we're part of this experience. You know, everything is like kind of, I'm looking at a light bulb on my Blog Talk Radio thing. It's like, yeah, it's like a light bulb is getting turned on, and, you know, it's a beautiful thing. It's just very different than anything we've ever experienced.
Well, to me, one of the greatest challenges that we have in this lifetime, whether it's within the physical world or as we begin to explore beyond the physical world, is this whole issue of dealing with our fear. You said it very well, that when we approach something that is unknown to us, inevitably it engenders fear, because we just don't, it's not part of our lived experience, it's not something we're comfortable with. And so we immediately have this sense of danger, or that it may threaten our physical well-being at some point. And so we act in fear. And for a lot of people, that fear then gets translated into a label like it's evil, or it's something that is going to do me harm.
Right.
But in reality, if we can just kind of hold that fear for a while, and instead of running away, begin to move toward it and begin to engage it, we can often find in this work that it has a gift to give us, or an insight that we couldn't have arrived at any other way. But you can't do that if you're always running in fear, or always pointing your finger at the devil and saying that that's something that has to be avoided. You know, a great illustration of that was in Robert Monroe's life, when there was a period where every time he would start to go out of his body, there was this being, this animal that would sort of jump on his back and grab him and start breathing into his ear. And, you know, he reached back with his hand and had like this really rough kind of prickly beard kind of thing. And it was just terribly, terribly frightening. And so every time that he would do that, he would feel it. He'd go right back into his body again. Well, this happened 3, 4, 5 times. And then he got kind of curious about it. He's wondering, what in the world is this thing? And he was able to get far enough away from his body to realize that this thing that had jumped onto his back was actually his physical body. He had just separated just enough.
That's funny.
So that the thing was breathing, his physical body was breathing in to his ear, and he could see the stubble on his beard. And, you know, he kind of had to laugh at it at that point, because all of a sudden the frame of reference shifted dramatically. And I think that's a real metaphor for the things that we go through in life.
Absolutely. Beautifully stated. Because we fear that which we don't know. I get that the unknown is a fear, but, you know, we're on this planet at a time where... Hello?
Yes, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. We're on the planet at a time where tremendous consciousness is shifting. You know, this isn't just about, you know, America losing power and Chile gaining power. I mean, this isn't just about, like, this isn't just about the physical. The physical is showing the shifting that's going on internally, and the within aspect is birthing, you know, because I remember when I started this journey of self-exploration, even though I've always been self-explorative, like, I can just always remember, like, psychology and human behavior has always fascinated me. And I realize now, whether it's human behavior, like, I'm a nanny, that's my day job. And so the kids, I can't tell you how well the kids take the shifting that's going on so beautifully. You know, I'll watch the parents kind of putting old paradigms into play, and I'll watch this dance of, you know, like, I'm blessed that I'm with a family that very much acknowledges and honors my spirituality. So we all kind of dance and bring something to the table that education is important, absolutely, but so is self-awareness, so is confidence. So is the ability to sit alone and be comfortable in that space to just be with self, as opposed to, you know, having the need to have another being around in order to feel safe and secure. I see that a lot in the nanny world. Have you ever been talking and you fall off a cliff and your whole train of thought goes with you?
Are you there now?
I am there right now. I totally don't know. And it's always funny when I do it on the air, of course, because it doesn't tell me when it's going to happen. But I really don't know where I was going with that.
Well, you were talking about being a nanny, and you know, of course, I've raised three children now. They're all grown up, and I always have to think back, you know. I really was the world's greatest parent. You know, I really was terrific. And then I had children, and that changed everything.
Indeed. All my friends tell me, too. It's like, Goldie, you don't have any. But I've been nannying for 18 years, so I get it that my foot's in the door. I have not done it. I honor that. I honor what you say. It is I remember. We were talking about the fear, because if we could just take our fear of the unknown, children are naturally curious about the unknown. They're so wonderfully naturally curious. And boy, talk to anybody that's had enough conditioning, whatever that is, whether it's college, whether it's you know, an illness, and it's the pharmaceuticals that they're taking, whatever it is, it's like we get afraid that change could be happening on a level so much deeper than what our government is saying. Like, you know, Hemi Sync is very similar to a technique that I use, which is Holosync. And I remember my second year of doing it, I had an experience where I could all of a sudden, one day I could see through the wall of my house, and there was this circle. Now, this is what I think was kind of like the Gateway 10, because it would make my body go asleep, but my mind was still awake.
Right.
And
right.
I saw three spaceships coming down the road. Mm-hmm. I knew intuitively that they were going to come to my house. There was a point where I like literally heard myself say, I'm scared. I mean, this is... that definitely frightens me. And then I heard another voice in me say, but when are you going to have another chance to play with this? Are you kidding me? Like, you got to go. And it, one of the ships came over my house, and there was this experience, because it was an outer body experience. My body did not go. My consciousness went. But when my consciousness was going what I call up into the ship, I don't know if that's actually how it works, but I became one with, like, the drops of water in the air, the leaves on the tree, the birds, the people, the cars. It was like this profound sense of complete awareness of like this radius around my house.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like that alone, if the whole trip, so to speak, ended there, would have been profound. But then, of course, I mingled with a being who telepathically gave me the message, continue to lay your hands on the people, which at the time I was a hands-on healer. And now the thing, the reason why I bring this up is two things. One, my belief is if I was afraid enough, like Robert, I would not have left my body.
Right.
I would have stayed, because fear, we have very much control over having these experiences. Fear will keep us in our physical experience. And I was afraid, and I also knew it and went, oh, no, 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 we must play. Goldie just loves a good, you know, journey and adventure. And so I did go, and the empowerment behind just, you know, mixing and mingling with, you know, aliens or galactics, whatever you want to call it, when governments tell me that, you know, this is not truth, there are no visitors from, you know, other dimensions, I don't need their authorization. I got my own authorization. I've been there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is so empowering because, A, I know that these beings are benevolent, at least the ones that were with me,
mm-hmm.
And B, the whole angle that the government, because I get the feeling government likes to use fear, you know, and to keep us fit limited.
What
and,
do
you
think?
You know, I'm... Yeah, I get right. So with that being the case, you know, I fly under the radar, not just in, you know, the UFO phenomena. I fly under the radar when it comes to medical. In my personal opinion, Western medicine, I saw my mom go through chemotherapy for 5 years. I don't know how we call that a cure. That is just, is so bizarre to my whole existence. I personally would, she didn't even die of cancer. She died from the chemo.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so, it, you know, it's like, and there's, and I watch people like, you know, like these zombies with their hands up, walking in, getting their 7 prescriptions filled that are taking their body up, down, sideways, high blood pressure, low blood pressure, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, you're killing yourself. You're killing yourself with this cure, and I don't want to get into medical. I'm just saying there are so many ways when you take your power back, it affects your whole being. Your whole entire experience can truly be heaven on earth if you're willing to, like you eloquently stated, the first step is just be willing to face what you think is a deadly fear, because not facing it is probably killing you.
Yeah, yeah. And so I, you know, I think the sort of the thread of what you were talking about there then really comes back to this issue of trusting who we are and trusting our own intuition and our own insights and taking responsibility for that and taking responsibility for our lives in all of its aspects. And when we do that, then we're much closer to living into that fullness of what we're really, which I think is really our birthright. And
oh, absolutely. Paul, we have a caller. You ready to play with some callers? Okay, fabulous.
All right.
Okay, let's see if I can unmute them. 936, area code 936, you're on the air. Oh, wait. God bless Blog Talk Radio. Wait, I'm trying my best to unmute you. Okay, 936, you're on the air.
Oh, can you hear me?
We can hear you. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Hi there.
Hi. How are you tonight, Paul?
Doing great. How about yourself?
Well, if I was doing any better, I couldn't stand myself.
What's your name?
My name's Thomas.
Thomas. Okay. What can we do for you?
I've called into your show before.
You called with Phil and Roseberry, right?
I don't remember anybody else being on the call with me. I called in relating my experiences of Sasquatch.
Sasquatch, yes, yes. Oh, please, enjoy. Come and join the conversation.
Sure. I was just going to say about what you were talking about. A lot of times the fear that we build up in our mind or the suggestion that is given to us by someone else is what causes us to have the very thing we're afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
I have multiple sclerosis, and I've had it since 2001, and I'm reversing it out.
Yeah. I think that,
hey, does Hemi-Sync work with any kind of things like that? I mean, are there, like, recorded incidences of spontaneous healings or things of that nature?
Yeah, we've got a number of anecdotal evidence that, you know, shows that there are many, many multiple uses for Hemi-Sync. And I'll just give you one example of somebody, a young man that I met not too long ago who had a brain aneurysm, and he was to have surgery for the aneurysm, and he was told that he was going to be in the hospital, I think, for about 4 weeks, and then his recovery was going to be months and months, and in fact, he would never have a full recovery. He says that he was listening to Hemi-Sync before, during, and after the surgery, and I think he went home at the second day after surgery. And he's recovered remarkably well, much, much faster than the doctors had thought was possible. So that's just one example of how this technology can help people to move into states of healing. But I also want to say that, you know, sometimes in this work, it's very interesting because a person may be looking for physical healing, but what may happen is that they may get a healing on an entirely different level. It might be an emotional or psychological healing or a spiritual healing that is just as profound, if not more profound.
Yeah, no, I agree, because I think once we become aware of this whole timelessness, it's no longer, you know, the goal is no longer to, quote-unquote, live a long life when consciousness never doesn't live.
Right.
How much longer than eternity do we have to, you know,
right.
It's our body, and I understand that we're very connected to our body, but the truth is life is eternal, and in our awareness of that, there's a relaxation for, you know, the whole emphasis that, you know, in order to be a productive, or in order of this life to have value, you have to get to, you know, 85 and have accomplished this, or have this much in your bank account, or, you know, any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, Thomas, are you still on the line?
I am.
I'm curious, can you just talk a little bit about what you're doing to help affect this change in your multiple sclerosis?
When I feel things going on in my body, I tell myself what it is that's happening. I feel what it is, and I tell myself what it is. And then I work with that on an energy level, spiritual level, and continue to correct certain things in my body little by little.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting strength back in my legs, and my balance is correcting itself. I've had vertigo since June of 2006, and
wow.
I don't walk like a drunk man anymore. I still have vertigo, but I don't walk near as bad as I used to.
Boy, that's fabulous. I mean, what great work you're doing. I mean, that's really first-class stuff right there, to be able to have that kind of presence and awareness. Most people, you know, who have a disease like that, you know, they'll try to go everywhere in the world to find a cure, except doing what you're doing, which is to move into it, to pay attention to it, rather than running away from it, but actually working with it and seeing how it you can change through the process and how the body can change as well. Boy, congratulations to you. Great work.
Thank you. The first thing I would say to anyone out there, and this is a promise I made to myself back in 2001 when I first came down with the condition, is that no matter what happens to me, I'm not going to quit being myself.
That's hot.
Yeah.
Goldilocks.
that's the first agreement you have to make with yourself, and then go forward from there.
Right.
And so even if you don't work on healing yourself, just adapt to the changes that are going on in your body and work with them. But whatever happens, don't quit being yourself.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, that's working at a whole different level right there. Even, you know, just that transcends the physical. So you're really using this experience, which I think is the mark of genius, when people can use that kind of a negative experience to turn it into something, some kind of a growth experience. And Power to you. My hat's off to you, my friend.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm not doing anything that other people can't do. I'm just, you know, I took the horse by the reins, so to speak, and I thought, you know, if I look funny and I can't walk normal, so what? I'm still going to be obnoxious.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Okay, as long as you behave on my show.
Oh, yeah.
It's all good. Well, you know, because this reminds me of my mom had so much presence on a certain level. My mom had this black eruption thing on her heart chakra. It was like right on her breastbone. Mm. And she used to say, you know, I'm here to help people be okay dealing with people who have cancer. Because, like, she wouldn't cover it up. She would wear, you know, a scoop neck shirt that there was this black eruption. I mean, it literally looked like volcanic experience happening on her chest. And she was like, I'm still me. Don't be afraid to talk to me. I'm not afraid to talk. Because she used to say, I'm living with cancer. I'm not dying with it.
Right.
Which, and like I said, the cancer did not kill her. The chemotherapy did. So, I mean, you know, I gave her that. She was a horse, man. I'm telling you, she was a horse. But there is something you see around people, or you see people when they're around people that don't fit their image of, you know, like whether it's a any kind of disfiguration or something, how they can't look, or they can, and it's like, why not? What are you so afraid of looking or talking or experiencing here? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's that whole idea of that. This, like, belief we have around the physical. Because, I mean, Carolyn May so brilliantly showed me disease is not because we have done something wrong. We are not being punished because of disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, I mean, I know that, you know, I had run that through with my mom, and, you know, things have happened, and it's like, because that doesn't seem to be the general consensus. General consensus will tell you, even in quote-unquote light workers, you know, if you think negative, negative things happen to you. As if my thinking is the only thing that creates my experience. You know, forget the other 11 dimensions that I don't have a clue what's going on. It's my thinking that is creating this. It's like, you know, to borrow a word from dogma, that's just blasphemy. That's just wrong.
I was thinking about, you know, what you were talking about, how people don't know how to deal with other people that they see who are disfigured, and I think in so many respects maybe that goes back to the conditioning that we receive as children, because I can remember my mother telling me, don't stare.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It was the idea that if you stared, then you were going to make the other person uncomfortable. Well, you hear that enough, and then because you don't have any interaction with the person, you don't know how to deal with somebody who has some kind of an illness or disfigurement when you actually come into that presence, and so you kind of just shut down. And it's a really unfortunate aspect of our culture, and we carry that same taboo around the whole issue of death. If somebody's dying, you know, we run the other way, because
absolutely.
Nobody has ever taught us how to engage somebody who's dying. I remember when I was a pastor, you know, I spent a lot of time with people in the hospital who were making that transition. It's really interesting to watch the families dance around that whole issue. You know, they'll families and friends will come by and they'll say, oh, don't talk like that. You know, you'll be out of bed in no time. I'll be seeing you on the golf course in next week or so. But
right.
What's going on with that person is that they're going through the most important transition of their life, and they can't find anybody to talk about it with. Because
it's all denial. Them. Yeah, everybody's denying that you're going through it.
Right.
How is that supposed to, you know, that doesn't feel, because I really believe it's our fear of this, of what we consider to be death, where there are other cultures, if you know that life at least goes on, I mean, at least in Hinduism and Buddhism, you know, the Eastern religions or philosophies, they tend to at least honor that, you know,
If I may interject and just say, that's not limited to just death. I mean, it's so many things that are outside of the norm. I I mean,
right.
I don't have any of the friends that I did before I came down with MS.
Is that right?
No, no, they've all pretty much gone their own way. My family doesn't have very much to do with me at all. And
wow.
I just got a divorce back in June because my wife left me. So, it's not just death that causes this fear reaction in people and causes them to run because they don't understand. They build up fears in their mind. And I can say that the human factory that's out there is basically one big blob of fear waiting for something to be afraid of.
Yeah.
I've been struck by a lightning, okay?
Uh-huh.
What do I have to fear?
I hear you, Tommy.
I drove
rock and roll, my friend. Yeah.
I drove a cab for a living when I was younger just to have the experience. What do I have to be afraid of? I went everywhere a police officer does, met the same kind of people he did, and didn't have a gun.
Mm.
So you tell me, what do I have to fear?
And yet
well,
people feel as if
Paul,
they have something to fear from you, which is so tragic. Have you been able to find another community of friends and support to replace the ones that you've lost?
Yeah, it's slowly increasing every day.
Mm-hmm.
Some people I would consider family. You know, you kind of adopt your own family at some point.
Right.
Oh, especially on this journey. I mean, definitely. Definitely. Because with me, it's just my whole spiritual side of me. It was like, you know, I went from black sheep to, you know, cuckoo bird. I mean, they didn't even know what to make of me when, you know, when I'm having spaceship experiences. You know, now I thought I screwed them up with the whole, you know, essential oils. Well, we had to take that to a whole new level. Whole new level.
I my mother... Bless her little pointed head. She was trying to understand, and she got me to go to an MS support group meeting with other people who have MS. And so I went with her, and we went to the meeting, and she found it interesting listening to other people and seeing that there are other people with the condition in a worse state than I am.
Mm.
And as we were leaving, she never went back to me to a support meeting after this. But as we were leaving, there was a woman with a walker trying to get out the door that has MS, and my mother was trying to get up there to help her, and then she shoved my elbow saying, "Help her," and I looked at her and I said, "Mother, you don't help someone unless they ask for help."
Oh, yeah.
It's quite possible that she wants to open that door just to prove to herself that she can still open it.
Mm.
You know, so... coming across somebody that has a disability is not a bad thing, but in my experience, it may not always be the case, but in my experience, I typically don't try to help people unless they ask for help.
Mm.
I don't treat them any different than I would anybody else.
Yeah. You know, that's a good point. You know, we run into that in the Institute quite often. People will be going through really major issues in their life, and sometimes, you know, they'll break down in the group and begin to cry, and, you know, everybody in the group always wants to rush around and find tissues for them, but, you know, as facilitators, we realize that sometimes somebody just needs that space to feel exactly what they're feeling, just as you were talking before, Thomas, about feeling what was going on in your body. It's important to be present to the emotion, be present to whatever is happening in your world, and if somebody's always rushing in to prop you up and or to make sure that you're not going to cry, or, you know, don't cry, they'll say,
right.
You can really rob a person of a what can be a pivotal experience in their life.
Yeah, it's I said the same thing about, like, if you're at somebody's house or your spouse or a child or something, and they're you can hear that they're having a nightmare. Don't wake them up.
Yeah.
Don't wake them up. Let them have that dream, because it may be important to them. It may be some kind of communication on the spiritual level that you're not aware of, and they may need to have that dream.
Right.
See, and that is the whole dynamic of what we're talking about right now is what I call the upside down, inside out belief systems of when we think we're doing the most good, but from a soul perspective, we are interfering and just being total, you know, destructors of things beyond our understanding. Where, you know, most people would say, you know, don't wake up a person having a nightmare. Oh, how cruel is that? It's like, you know, how cruel is that? You know, the soul went through quite, a lot to create that particular moment. And how do you know that the nightmare is not going to end with the being facing with that which it's afraid of? I know I have faced several beings in my dream state, whether holosyncing or not, that where I turn around and go, I am that I am, and poof, it pops. I mean, it's like I'm not being chased anymore. Not just in that dream. I mean, the chasing dreams have ended. And that is like, that's huge. That is huge. I so honor. I like these kind of talks. Cody gets very excited. I'm waving a flag right now.
It kind of brings into perspective the old Native American saying. It's very simplistic, but most people miss it completely, and that saying is live and let live.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Go and live your life and let other people live their life, and don't interfere.
Yeah. although I do think that there's some balance that can be brought to that, too. You know, I think that there is a real gift that we do give to each other. When somebody wants to talk and somebody wants really wants to have somebody to reflect with, and that's where I think if we run too quickly away from people who are going through the death process or have some kind of disease or disfigurement, we rob not only them but also ourselves of the sort of the wonder of one person sharing their story with another person. And that's quite a different posture from rushing in and trying to fix something. That's a posture of learning to hold what I call sacred space with another person.
That's Tuesdays with Maury. That's what that reminds me of.
Yeah.
Remember that famous book?
Yes.
No, I absolutely agree. Because, you know, I definitely see that there's no one answer to blanket, you know, how to work with, you know, humans. but there are guidelines that, you know, I like that because, Paul, it is so obvious to me that you are a compassionate person. I mean, and an excellent, I don't want to say counselor because it doesn't seem to grasp the scope of truly where I feel your wisdom is. You're a very aware, conscious being. And
on a good day, you know, on a bad day, maybe not so much.
No, I've read your book. You've had many good days.
What is your name again? I'm sorry, the female?
Me? Goldie?
Yeah, Goldie. Where are you located at?
Pardon?
Where are you located at?
I'm in Connecticut.
Okay. You sound just like a friend of mine in Houston.
No, I'm in Connecticut. But anyways, what I like what we're doing is bringing up options for us to, you know, for people to understand and expand you. You know, because we all kind of have this conditioning that says, you know, like, you know, if someone's quote-unquote disabled, you must help them. Well, okay, but like you eloquently said, Thomas, help isn't always getting the door for them. Help is allowing them to see that they are still very capable to do things. I mean, like I see kids taking on disorders or loss of limbs and things of that nature so much more gracefully than like if someone loses a limb as an adult. You know, you can see the... they don't feel they can adapt and things like that. It's like, boy, we have no idea what the human body is capable when we're connected with, you know, senses that go beyond the five.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can clearly... look at Stephen Hawking. Oh, my God. There's our perfect example. You know, that boy has done some serious work internally. You know? I mean... You know, I mean, and it's almost like he really is the perfect example of, you know, how much we have value, and there's so much to explore and to contribute, even if the body does. You know, I'll be honest with both of you. This is definitely a show of my own. I have fears around people that, if I'm dating somebody and they start showing like a bad back or something or a bad knee, I can hear the programming in my head going, you know, I don't have kids yet. You gotta be able to run around with the kid when he's 5 years old. You know, like I have my own fears of this, and this show is, you know, I stand here humbly and go, yes, and Goldie needs to explore this too. So thank you both. Yeah.
Well, I think that's just what it is to be human, is to know that we all have feet of clay and we're all on a journey, and we never do reach, unless we leave this planet, you know, that state of perfection. And yet even in our imperfection, there's a wonderful perfection that manifests itself within that. So, we're this interesting mixture of sort of stardust and mud, you know, in who we are. And when we start to embrace that, rather than trying to put on a good face every minute of the day, then we start to move into some kind of a new freedom where we can say, oh yeah, that's me. I am like that. And how interesting.
Yes. No, I agree. Now we have a little under a half an hour, Paul. I was hoping that maybe you could share like some multiple dimensional experiences that you've had, you know, or talk more about, you know, the hemisync, and because I really want people to know that, you know, there is the Monroe Institute is such a dramatic, you know, it's almost like a galactic technology right here in 2010, in the sense of it goes beyond. This is not your basic, let's sit here, breathe, and, you know, hope we get, you know, something happening. This is like, you know, you met your father. You had spoken with your father. He had passed on. I remember that one from the book. And, you know, I want people to know that if there is a desire to explore this, clearly the Monroe Institute is a place to, you know, do some investigating and check into.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, that story you mentioned about meeting my dad, when I went to the Institute, I wasn't sure what to expect exactly, but it wasn't long before this other world began to open up in a pretty big way for me. But I remember my father died of Alzheimer's disease back in 1992, and I was at his bedside when he died. And, you know, Alzheimer's is kind of interesting because I think what happens is that people sort of blink in and blink out of this reality. And who knows where they go when they blink out. But when they blink back in, you know, sometimes they'll know you, sometimes they won't. And I remember that night that my father was dying, there was just that one very, very brief moment of glimmer when he seemed to recognize who I was. And we all kind of knew that this was his last night. You know, we were just kind of waiting for it to happen. And when he looked at me and I said, Dad, when you get to the other side, would you come back and tell me what it's like? And he just kind of nodded his head and didn't say very much more after that. In fact, he wasn't talking at all. So he passed away that evening. And I don't know, I guess 5 years later, 7 years later, I keep getting the time mixed up on this, but here I am at the Gateway Voyage at the Monroe Institute, and I remember getting a massage, and it was a really crazy sense that there were a lot more people in that massage than just and myself. And I had a visual of my father actually being engaged in the massage, and I thought, wow, you know, I'm not so sure about this, because I wasn't sure at all that I wanted to invite him along on this journey, because, well, like sometimes happens between fathers and sons, my relationship with my father was not the easiest. Let's just put it that way.
Right.
So I wasn't sure at all that I wanted him to be there. But we went into this experience, and I'm And by experience, what I mean is we go into our unit, which is a bed with four walls, and we put the headphones on, and then we move through the exercise. So I'm moving through this space, and I can't really tell you what the space is. It's just kind of a void. And all of a sudden, to my left, I recognize and I see that there is this circle of beings of light, and that's the only words I can use to describe it. And so I almost, like, go right by them, and I say, wait a minute. Those are beings of light. You don't see that every day. So I thought, well, I've got to go over and see what's going on. So I go over, and I peer over the shoulder of one of the beings who's standing around this circle, and I see that there's this person lying at the bottom of the circle who has obviously just come over from the other side, who's just passed through the transition of death and has arrived in this new place. And I look down, and I'm absolutely awestruck to see that it's my father, who has died years before. So to think that I was at his bedside when he was dying, and now somehow, some way, I'm greeting him years later in this other world. And the circle kind of parts, and I walk or float over to him, and instinctively I pick him up in my arms, and I begin sort of moving with him. And I said to him, "Dad, you're on the other side now." And he's so weak. The only best analogy I can use is it was sort of like he was a fish that had been landed in the bottom of a boat after a very, very long wrestling with the line. And he had almost no energy left whatsoever. So I'm talking with him, and I'm saying, "Dad, your relatives in your family are going to be here after a while, and you're going to be going into the next phase of your life, and it's going to be wonderful." And I'm doing all of this on instinct. And before long, one of the beings of light comes over to me, and he says, "We can take him now. His family is coming, and, you've done a great service for him." So I give him up to the beings of light, and then I come out of the experience, and all I can do is weep uncontrollably because, I couldn't have made that up if I tried. It was so real and so profound and so pristine of an experience that it is something I simply never forget. And so, we talked before about giving up fear, and I think one of the most important fears that we can give up, or at least to begin to work with, is this fear of death. Now, if you've had the experience of moving to the other side of death, that goes a long way to alleviating some of that fear of dying.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, there really is something when we let go of the fear of dying, we actually will live more deeply. It's like life becomes more alive, because everything's, I was at this indoor playground today, and I'm listening to this mother talk to her, he must have been 3 or 4 years old, this little boy. She's going, "There are so many germs around here. Listen, you make sure you keep your hands out of your mouth, and we gotta get that, antiseptical soap stuff." And it was like, I'm in the business a long time, and I'm going to myself, the kid just wants to play. he doesn't want to be read, the whole germ riot act in this playground. He doesn't see it that way, and I'm just watching the unconscious conditioning of this woman, and it's like, wow, we just live from, our program is so from a lack and a fear and a, limited space, and it's like we don't know how to play anymore as we get older. It seems like it just takes it right out of us. And then if you do play as an adult, you're looked at as, you have no responsibilities, or, they'll tear you down from the other end because you're not in the system and producing. You must produce because that's where the value comes from. It's like, it just seems so upside down and inside out at, an extreme level right now, an extreme level. And I always say that, if art imitates life, I think the third of the trilogy, whether it's The Matrix or Lord of the Rings, we're there. We're in the third trilogy. So inevitably, you know, we're all going to wake up and it's going to be a glorious day.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's very, very profound work. You know, when you start to work more and more at the level of the soul and the spirit, and begin to experience the possibility that you're more than the physical body or more than the physical world, it's a lot easier to take yourself less seriously because you're not so tied to this outward appearance anymore, and life becomes a bit lighter than it was before, and that's a real gift, because then in that lightness, and you know you can every once in a while let some joy shine through, and that has an impact on your life, and it has a real impact on the people around you, because we live in many ways a pretty joyless existence in this Western culture of ours, because we seek so much to know ourselves through the physical body or through what we produce, as you say, or through our jobs and through our stature. And that's all really, really serious business. But if that doesn't matter so much anymore, then there is that glimmer of joy that can start to come through, and that lightness of being that can make a big difference.
Oh, beautifully, beautifully stated. Do you do public speaking? I mean, other than the show and for the book, are you publicly speaking?
Yeah, I have occasion to get out there quite a bit right now because of my position at the Institute. One of the things that I see as my part of my job is to be the face of the Institute, so to translate what we do to the public. And so I really enjoy that time to get out there and mix with people and get to speak. And, you know, of course, from my former occupation as a pastor, that was something that it took me a long, long time to start to feel comfortable in that role, but I very much enjoy it now.
Well, you know, that's the other fear of public speaking is also because, I mean, Paul, you're fabulous. Will you come back on the show? I know it's not the end of the show, and I normally invite people at the end of the show, but I'm going to invite you right now.
Well, you know, after 2 hours, I don't have much to say. You know, you probably got something else.
Well, no, don't say that. Of course you have. So you have lots to say.
Yeah.
Well,
no,
I think.
No,
well, listen, yeah, I honor that. Yeah, because that's just beautiful. I just honor the whole idea that life is changing. It's happening within us. It's happening almost to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we can embrace it, or we can attempt to run from it. But what's funny is, if you know, it's not just happening to us in life; it's happening to us in all dimensions. So, even those who are not physically incarnate are going through shifts and changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it shows up differently for those that are physical, but consciousness really doesn't have. You know, consciousness isn't just in the physical world; it's in everything. It's in that which we have defined, and that which is unknown, and that which is unknowable, and wow!
Well,
what
I think we go through lots of shifts in awareness and consciousness in our daily life, and the problem is that we're not really aware of that. You know, if you've ever, I don't know if you've ever had the experience of driving down the road, and you're at one point and 1 mile marker, and all of a sudden, you realize a half hour later that you've traveled this distance, but you have no realization of what happened in between.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're 60 miles down the road, and you know you go, wait a minute, what happened? Well, actually your awareness has shifted into the past, or it's worried about the future, or regretting something that's happened, or planning something, and we really aren't present to the physical world anymore. And actually, we go through most of our life like that, and we're not even aware of it. And I think part of the task that is ahead of us as human beings is to learn to be aware of the shifts in consciousness that happen to us throughout the course of our daily lives, and to learn to work with that in a more creative way, rather than being subject to it, to begin to learn how to control it. I had an experience maybe about a year and a half ago, where I was just about ready to get on an airplane. And I picked up this book that was called Wicked, and it's a wonderful, wonderful book, a fiction book that tells the story of the Wizard of Oz from the perspective of the Wicked Witch of the West. And as you can imagine,
yeah.
Everything gets turned upside down, and it's absolutely brilliant. It's now a Broadway musical. Well, I got engrossed in this thing, and I'm literally in the Wizard of Oz, and I'm reading the book as I'm getting on the plane. I'm reading the book through the whole trip, and we were supposed to land at I believe it was LaGuardia Airport in New York City, and at one point the stewardess comes on and says, "Oh, if you look out the left window, you'll see the Statue of Liberty." And so I think, we're going to land pretty soon, and I go right back to my book. But it seems like we're flying around for a long, long time, and I look over to my right, and there's this woman who's got her head in her hands, and I thought, well, she's not having a very good trip. She looks like she's really upset about something. And we're flying and flying and flying, and I think, well, we should be landing pretty soon. We should have landed by now. Well, after a long period of time, finally I feel the plane starting to descend, and we touch the ground, and the pilot leans on the brakes, and we come to a stop, and the whole plane erupts into applause and cheers, and I'm thinking, what is going on? And then the stewardess comes on, and she says, "Welcome to Oz." Wait a minute. I'm reading a book called I'm in the Wizard of Oz. She's talking about Oz. Why is everybody cheering? Where am I? I tapped the guy on the shoulder in front of me, and I said, "Where are we?" And he says, "We're at JFK." And I said, "What are we doing at JFK?" "Did you hear? They couldn't get the flaps down on the plane. We've been flying around all this time to burn off fuel, and so that in case we crash, we won't go up in flames. Didn't you see all the fire trucks that were lined up along the airstrip when we were landing?" And I said, "No, I had no idea, because I was in Oz." And so that's just an example of how deeply we can get involved into these altered states of awareness, even to the point where we can be in a life and death situation and not even realize it. And I think that's the task before us, is that we more and more have to grow accustomed to working with this vast thing that we call consciousness and making it a part of our daily life and a part of our growth in this world. And when we do that, then I think that's when the human potential is really going to explode in a marvelous way.
Wow, that story was in the book, though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, right.
Okay, because I'm like, why does this sound familiar?
I didn't know.
Have we experienced this together? And I'm going, oh, Goldie, you read about it. I have a question. Can you talk about, well, two things. One,
I got to do it one at a time.
Okay, indeed. Thank you. One, how HemiSync helps to build awareness, and am I stating that correctly? Do we build awareness, or do we just become aware of awareness?
Okay, well, that's a good question. And I think the way that I would answer it is that with this map of consciousness and taking people to specific destination points within that map, we get people familiar with states of awareness that actually are very normal. But because we don't pay attention to them and we move into and out of them without awareness, we don't even know that they exist. We're not aware that we're moving in these dimensions. So by kind of giving people a map and then creating the context that allows them to experience it, not just to talk about it or philosophize about it, but to actually experience it, then we can take that experience and say, oh, well, there's certain markers there that allow me to know that I'm in that state of awareness. So focus 10, then this state of mind awake, body asleep becomes something that becomes a part of our lived experience. And we can say, oh, yeah, I know that. Like, I know my house, and I know my car, and I know my town. So it's another destination point that becomes part of our repertoire. And
okay.
And we didn't go into it before, but I do want people to understand that Focus 10 is just the first destination point that we take people to in the Gateway Voyage, which is our introductory course. We take people to after Focus 10, then to Focus 12, which we call the state of expanded awareness. And this is awareness beyond the limitations of the physical body sometimes. It can manifest itself in any number of different ways, but we put a sort of generic term on that, and we call that expanded awareness. The destination point after that is what we call Focus 15, and that is the state beyond time. And this is a place where you can really begin to experience and play with moving to different experiences of time and different places in the time spectrum. And it's much more than that, but I don't want to...
It's much more. What Robert Monroe was doing with those 18 radio shows was in a timeless space.
Right, right.
I believe it, because I work with a teacher who's like producing, you know, 26 books, seven websites, and, you know, there are people trying to keep up around her, myself included, and I'm going, I'm not timeless yet, therefore my belief is it's too much, I can't do it. And that's all just a belief around time. Paul, we have another caller. Are you
okay.
Open to... okay. Now, okay, and I just want to make sure, too, that... and I'll let you know when we're getting close, because we have 9 minutes left. I want to make sure that you give out the email address and where... Your book is posted on my episode, so they can actually click on the link of the book. It'll take them right to Amazon. But I want you to, you know, definitely get your information out.
Will do.
So I'll let you know. We'll take this call. Area code 626, you're on the air.
Hey, Goldie. It's Christina from Christina Sophia.
Oh, my God. Chris, what's up?
Hey.
How are you, Christina? Paul, Christina. Christina's another wonderful guest.
Hi, Christina. Glad to have you on the show here.
Yeah, well, I was calling. I just wanted to do a little testimonial for the Monroe Institute, because it actually plays a really big part in my story. So I'm a professional channel, and I'm on Goldie's show every third Thursday of the month, and I bring through the wisdom of Sophia. But it actually really started through taking a Monroe class, where I got to all those different focus levels and started to learn how to really open up and access these other realms. So I just wanted to share that Monroe and Hemisync really works. So that was my little call in to say that it's amazing stuff, everybody, and check it out.
Christina, thank you. Please, Paul, you also give your kudos, guys.
bless you, Christina. Thank you so much for that. I can say these things, but it has a much greater impact when somebody who's been through the program and doesn't have a vested interest is able to say that. So I'm deeply grateful for you to take the time to share that.
Yeah, well, I think when you were talking about the map, I imagine that the HemiSync program is like the GPS, so it takes you to that destination over and over again, but then you eventually know how to get there. So mm-hmm. you then begin taking yourself there all by yourself. So I always said it was a form of a little cheat sheet that some brilliant man created for me to help me get to those levels. Because all you got to do is put on the headphones, you know, and, hey, I'll take a little cheat sheet whenever I can get it.
Me too.
Christina,
so thank you, guys.
Christina, before you go, when did you start channeling Sophia? Was it during the program or was it after the program?
It was after. So I had a lot of health problems. My dad had passed away, and I was just asking some really big questions about life. And so I took the whole immunity program. So it was probably about 2 years before I started to channel Sophia, but actually through... it was a weekend-long program that I did, and at the very end, the leader took us up to one of those high levels, and I had a direct experience with my dad, which then really opened me up to the medium realms, which then opened me up to the channeling realm. So it was probably, you know, about a year and a half afterwards that all of my things started to unravel after that, but I really always give credit to the HemiSync program as the thing that really gave me that tangible experience with my dad that I knew that I had hit that level. I met him, I saw him face to face, and I had this amazing experience where it doesn't matter if anyone told me it wasn't real. I was like, I know my dad, and I saw him. We had a conversation, and it was very real.
Exactly. Sad.
So it was like science.
Do you, see Sophia, or do you just hear the words moving through you? How does that work for you?
I actually give her access to my entire vehicle. So I don't see her. She just utilizes my entire body. I have open eye channel. I've trained for about 10, 12 years now. So it's pretty much, I don't see her, but I definitely, she is seeing through my eyes. So she sees the world using human eyes.
Boy, that's
fun.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. We
yeah.
have, you know, we have one of our facilitators at the Institute had an experience where she encountered Mary, and what Mary said to her was that, "I want to walk in your feet." And so she allowed her to do that, and Mary came in, and this person's quite a remarkable person, and she has that essence that it really draws people to her, and people just love her to death because of it. So that's a great story, Christina. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you, and I just really support all the work that you're doing, and I really always recommend the HemiSync for anyone who really wants to learn how to expand, that it's a really great program. So I just want to give you that public testimonial.
I love you, Christina.
Thanks,
you rock.
I'll talk to you
and I will
week.
Talk to you next Thursday.
Okay.
Christina will be
okay.
on the show next week. Yes, I love you, sweetheart. Thank you for calling in.
Okay, bye, guys.
Bye.
Okay.
Wow. That's, you know, it's an amazing, I love when, you know, something comes full circle. I had no idea Christina worked with the HemiSync program, and she's so delightful. Her and Sophia, you know, I can't even tell you the lives we're touching, you know, because she's on the show once a month. She's my third Thursday guest. And I'm just amazed when, you know what I mean? The world becomes smaller as I become expanded.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
It just doesn't, you know, and magic. Wow, I just love it. I just love it. And I'm telling you, Paul, I just want to fold you up and put you in my pocket and take you with me everywhere I go.
You know,
I
you
do.
Know, if it's good ride, I might go. You know. So.
Well, I really would. I'm deeply and sincerely would love to have you. If you want to come on my show, you have an open invitation. Anytime you want to come on, if you have
right.
something you want to promote, if you just want to talk about the book, there's clearly more HemiSync stuff that we can levels and experiences. If anything, truly, what a pleasure to spend tonight with you. Just a pleasure. And Thomas and Christina and all the listeners. Can you share your contact information or where, you know, how to find? Okay.
Right. If you're looking for the book, of course, you can get it through Amazon.com. It's also a lot of the Barnes & Noble stores are carrying it. BarnesandNoble.com. You can go to my website, which is spiritualhitchhiker.com. And if you want to learn about the Monroe Institute, you can go to Monroe, that's M-O-N-R-O-E, Institute.org. That's MonroeInstitute.org. And I want to draw a particular attention to the .org. We are a nonprofit organization. And so our reason for being is service to the world. We take that very seriously, and that is the center for everything that we do. So while we do need to make some profit in order to stay in business, our main reason is to help in the advancement of human consciousness across the globe.
Outstanding. You're beautiful. Your publicist, Sarah, is beautiful. I'm so glad she connected us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Monroe Institute is, I mean, gosh, since the when did Robert first create this?
It was created actually in 1985, but its roots really go back before that. That 85 was when it became a nonprofit. He was actually working with the sound technology, well, as I say, since from the mid-1950s on.
Okay.
So, and
right.
he was doing programs before it became a nonprofit.
Right, right. Also, feel free to, Robert Monroe wrote several books that are absolutely fascinating about walking between the world and helping those souls that, you know, perhaps get stuck. The whole topic is as deep as we are infinite. You're exquisite. I was honored. I am honored, delighted to meet you, to share time with you, and I wish you all the best, and I hope you'll join us on another reality show again soon.
Thank you so much, Goldie. Great to be with you. Have a great evening.
Thank you so much, Paul. And everybody, obviously, Christina Sophia, she'll be on next week. I love you all. Have an amazing week, and I will talk to you next Thursday. All right, everybody, take care. Bye.